I'm Jacob Kinberg, and you are listening to Salty Cinema. I am here in Los Angeles talking to my good friend, Gabe Renfro.
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 R-E-N-F-R-O.
Yeah. He's a good friend. I don't know how to say his last name. Gabe is a video producer, and we went to Biola together. And then Gabe went on to study filmmaking, get his
MFA
at USC. Let's start talking about that. What was it like studying film at USC?
So the filmmaking experience at Biola and at USC, it was pretty different. I mean, at Biola, I feel like we had a lot of freedom to fail. And so there was just no, I mean, it was like the Guerrilla Film Society. That was the big club that kept all us filmmakers together. And we would just go out and shoot stuff. And I mean, there was just no, like, there were no rules, you know, and we could shoot whatever we wanted. We could try stuff. At USC, there would never be a Guerrilla Film Society. Like, they'd be like, why would you do that? You're here to make real movies, like, get permits, get a budget, and, you know, do all your budgeting, do all your scheduling, and learn how to make a real movie. But I feel like both, and it was a lot more stressful. I mean, you would have to go out, you'd have a certain, like, limit on the footage that you could shoot for even your dailies, right? So, like, you would have a couple cards, you know, that you could shoot onto the EX1. We were shooting on the EX1 at that point, and you couldn't shoot more than those cards allowed, even though that it was digital. It was like a film mindset, even though we'd transitioned to digital. And then you would show your dailies in class. And so, like, if you're directing actors on the dailies, people could hear exactly what you were saying to the actors, you know, if you were talking, you know, before you had said cut or whatever. And they would critique you on all of those things. And so it was just a lot more, like, high-pressured, formal environment. But I did feel like coming into USC, I had a lot of advantage over some of the other kids because I had already gone through film school and I'd gone through a phase where, like, I tried just a lot of different stuff without any judgment. And so coming in, I knew, like, okay, I can show you some stuff that works, you know, a little bit. So
do you think that intensity is the same for undergrad at USC, or is that the graduate level?
I think so. I mean, all of the classes, like, in undergrad have a mirror with grad. So as far as I could tell, but I think undergrad, the mentality is a little bit less formal just because it is undergrad. But other than that, I think the programs are pretty similar.
And do you feel like it was worth the money and you're glad that you did it?
Yes, I have advised people not to go. Okay. So I hope none of the administrators at USC listen to this because I have advised people not to go because I think it was based on what their skills were at the time and what their network was at the time. And I looked at their skills, I looked at their work, I looked at their network, and based on that I said, you know, I don't think that you're going to build off of what you already have substantially by spending the money you know, to go to USC.
Gotcha.
So that was what informed that decision. And I mean, I think that it really depends on what you want to study, because I think certain skills are just best learned not in the classroom. You know, like something like editing or something like cinematography is best learned by buying the camera, by buying the software, by doing it, by just working on a lot of stuff. I would not say to anybody that they should go to get their MFA for, like, cinematography at USC or for editing it at USC. Directing, yes. Writing, yes. I thought their sound program was fantastic. Producing, I think they have a lot of good producing courses. And I mean, a lot of the networks that you build there are really great.
I always say that when it comes to film school, and I'm sure it's a lot more so with USC than Biola, the the people that you meet are going to be the most valuable thing that you get out of that.
Yeah. But I mean, my directing classes at USC were amazing. Like you would watch students who had rehearsed with their actors for like, you know, 3 to 6 hours, and they would bring a scene in to the stage and they'd show the scene that they'd prepared as like a 5-minute scene between two people or four people. And it just wasn't working. Like it was just, it was like student film bad, you know, like you just didn't, this wasn't working at all. You didn't believe the characters. You didn't, it was bad acting, you know? And you'd watch the professor, in this case, it was Professor Jeremy Kagan. He would work with actors for, it was like a 45-minute session. And during that 45 minutes, he would transform the scene into something that was like movie quality. It was like, okay, let's get a camera, let's shoot this because this scene is working. And so to get that kind of work with a director of that caliber and who's working with you and saying, you know, he's telling you what a good direction is and what a bad direction is and things like that, that was an invaluable experience. Like I would never trade that for anything. And just what I learned there was so valuable. It was like magic, you know. It was like watching this, like you would watch the scene when they first came in and it was like, can these actors act? You know, but it wasn't the actors, it was the directing. It was the director, and sometimes it was me, you know, like hadn't pinpointed what the scene was really about and hadn't given the actors the right intention. And so the actors might have been like following what the director was telling them to do, but because it wasn't really what the scene was about, it came off as phony.
So how can you differentiate though between bad acting and it being the director's fault?
It's a good question. Well, there were times when he would say, okay, that actor doesn't have it. Because what was interesting too is when you had an actor and he would sometimes defend directors to actors. So the director would give the actor an intention, right? So your intention is to, you want to punish this person. You know, you want to punish this person for what they did to you or whatever. Or you attack him or whatever. And the actor wouldn't follow that. And then Jeremy would stop and he'd say, wait a minute. That the director gave you an intention that was actable and what you did was not that. So let's try it again and do what the director told you. And that was kind of intense too, because it was like, you know, like let's all obey the rules of the game here. The game is that the director is directing the scene and you're gonna, you know, figure out how to, you know, do those intentions. And so there were situations like that in which the actor would still fail. And it was like, okay, like this, they don't have it. They can't be in the moment. And there were a couple times where after a scene, he said, you know, they just don't have it. They're not an actor. You know,
I remember going in once to be one of your actors for a scene that you're putting up, but I'm trying to remember what he had said about that or what. I don't remember. Do you remember anything from that? You got compliments.
People said you did a good job.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But you,
but I don't, but I'm you, saying but, from the director. So, I don't remember. Okay, but the scene
you were playing, though, was from a short film called The Future Richard Dennisons. And you were actually, so the scene was kind of like an Eddie Murphy type scene where one character was playing multiple characters. Right. But when you're rehearsing that scene live,
we were just playing.
Yeah. I needed stand-ins. And so you were one of the stand-ins. And so you were pretty clear from any sort of criticism from the directing teacher.
I'm trying to remember him even like coaching you or giving any kind of feedback on what you were doing as you were directing that. Do you remember any? I don't really remember.
What was the feedback he gave me?
Yeah, like as he was like working with the...
Well, that was interesting too, because that was the second class that I took and we had camera as well as directing actors. And so I think with that one, a lot of his instruction to me was based on was where to put camera the camera.
Choices. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I had a shot list and stuff like that. It was just a little tough figuring out how to shoot it because I did have stand-ins and I did have like costume changes in between.
Mm-hmm.
Well, sometimes the same character appeared in the same shot. So I would have a costume change before I even changed the placement of the camera so that the same actor could appear in the shot with himself. So yeah. It was a little bit of a unique situation. And I think that's mostly what we talked about.
Mm. So in film school, both undergrad and grad, you end up watching a lot of movies.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot, you know, movies, different movies can impact you in different ways. And I wanted to talk to you today about what are the movies at that time and throughout your life that have had the biggest impact on you or possibly changed your life.
Mm-hmm.
For me, the idea of a movie changing your life, I don't know if I would use that language or go that far. Maybe they have. I mean, obviously movies in general, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing. So I guess that qualifies as a change in my life that if before that point I wanted to be a professional baseball player and after that point I wanted to be a filmmaker, sure. But most definitely, like, I can point to certain movies and how they impacted me in different ways, but I'd love to hear what some of the biggest ones for you have been.
Yeah, I think the reason I think about this is because when I graduated school, I didn't anticipate, I mean, I could have if I thought about it, but I didn't anticipate just like the massive amount of content that there would be in this day and age. Yeah. Like when I finished film school, like there's just, everything is on Netflix and people are just watching stuff all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And like, it almost feels like homework when people talk about like, have you watched this television show or right. have you seen this movie? And it's like, oh, you know, I've got my list. I'm doing my best, you know, but yeah. like, and it was kind of disheartening for me as a filmmaker. 'Cause it's like, man, like, there's so much content and a lot of people are just watching this stuff a lot. And it's like wallpaper. Like, are they really engaging with it? And the reason I got into movies in the first place was because I was like, I just discovered at a young age, this is a medium that speaks to the soul in a way nothing else can, you mm-hmm. know? And it seemed like when I was young, like, movies were just a bigger event. You know, and I would see a movie multiple times, which I rarely do now.
Mm-hmm.
I would wait in anticipation for that movie for like all a year. You know what
right.
I mean? Like there was like the Disney movie that came out every single year. And I remember when Mufasa died, like that rocked me to the core. Mm-hmm. I was like, I felt this sense of like injustice. Like, how could they do that?
Mm-hmm.
How could they do that to me? Kill Mufasa. And it like lasted with me for days, you mm-hmm. know? And,
so now it's hard for films to have the same resonance because there's just so much noise.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think some of it is also just our culture. Like I fear that people aren't really thinking about the stuff that they watch.
Yeah, they don't give it the time it deserves to
yeah,
actually
yeah.
think it through.
And the proportion between like how hard it is to make a movie or a TV mm. show and how much work goes into it and how little energy put into the like watching it.
How quickly it can just be dismissed.
Right, right. That's a real tragedy to me, mm. you know. But we talk about movies that really changed me. Like the first one that comes to mind that's recent is okay. The Act of Killing. Like that movie taught me what it means to like feel remorse for your wrongdoing.
Okay.
More than any other movie. And by
set,
the way,
set it up. What is The Act of Killing? What's it about?
Yeah. So spoiler, just spoiler alert. If you mm-hmm. haven't seen Act of Killing, you have to watch it.
Mm-hmm.
but so Indonesia, there was there's kind of a complicated backstory, so I apologize if I screw up some of the details here, but it's Indonesia, and there was a coup, and members of the military basically overthrew the government, and then they tortured members of the government that they overthrew, and they just did horrible things to, you know, the people that they took power from. And they, at the time the documentary was made, they were still in power. And that, you know, it was, I think, 1965 or something that this took place. I think it's 1965. I could be wrong. Anyway, people that did these atrocities are still alive. And so the filmmaker, I think his name is Josh Oppenheimer, mm-hmm. He went there, and he was originally going to interview the victims, and they were all like, well, you're wondering what these people did to us. Like, why don't you just go talk to them? They're still here. And so he goes and talks to these people that did these things, and they brag. They boast. Mm. And they even put on these, like, almost like plays, you know, and like they almost shoot it like they're in film school, you know, right. And they act out these atrocities that they committed.
Yeah.
And they act out like gangsters and like Western, you know, heroes, like they're Clint Eastwood or whatever. And they brag about these things. And then there's this one scene that, I mean, just has stayed with, this image has stayed with me since I saw the movie. And I've only seen it once. But one of the main guys that they follow puts himself in the position of somebody that he tortured. And he's acting out the part of the guy that he tortured. And you see, and this is all filmed, you see the moment of him realizing what I did to these people was awful. Mm-hmm. And he's acting like he's being strangled. And all of a sudden in that moment, it's like you see him just break completely out of the scene. And then following this, you see scenes of him just like retching and, like, you know, on camera asking the filmmaker, like, what have I done? Like, do you think he really felt like, how did he really feel when I was doing these things to him? And to get that kind of character arc, I mean, using the language of storytelling, it's mm-hmm. a character arc. To get that kind of real character arc in something that extreme on camera was amazing. And it taught me things about, like, forgiveness that I had not thought about before. And, like, how to apologize to someone. Like, if I've wronged you, mm-hmm. how do I deal with that? Like, part of my duty is not to just say sorry, but really try to empathize with you and your suffering mm-hmm. from what I did to you. Like, putting myself in your shoes and suffering what I did to you as you suffered it.
Mm-hmm.
I had never, like, just thought about apologizing in that way. So I would say that movie totally changed my life because it taught me what it means to forgive someone, and well, to ask for forgiveness, but also to forgive someone too. You know, and
when I watched it, I kept just wondering why would these people agree to do this? Like, I couldn't fathom the thought process of these guys. Like, I mean, I guess if they were proud of what they had done in mm-hmm. at first,
mm-hmm.
they're reliving it, thinking of themselves as the hero of these scenes,
right,
you know?
Right.
But it, like, the amount of, I don't know, disconnect that you'd have to have from what you had done to, I don't know, to be able to do that. It was amazing to me that he could get them.
Yeah, and
in that place.
That's such a great question. I mean, I would have to watch the documentary again, specifically with that question in mind. I think part of it is, though, from what I understand, they were overthrowing a government that they thought was oppressive. Mm-hmm. And so they thought of themselves as, like, we were the victims, now we're the heroes.
Yeah.
And they are in a context of, like, boasting. Like, we saved our country and whatever, and, like, we overthrew our overlords. Yeah. So that would be my guess, but I would have to watch the movie again. And that, I mean, that's a really powerful lesson, I think, for just like the relationship between victim and oppressor, because how quickly the victim becomes the oppressor once they overthrow, once they come into power.
Right. You know? And they end up enacting the same things that were done to them.
Exactly. Yeah.
Do you think the act of killing made you empathize with the oppressors themselves?
No. Well, while I was watching it, I was like, these people are awful.
But they're also shown as very, you know, happy. There's a lot of laughing and a lot of, I mean, I guess that's part of the poignance of it, but
well, you see them. Yeah. You can empathize with someone and empathize, meaning I understand what you're feeling. I understand what you're going through. I get that emotion, like, but you can still like judge it to a certain extent, being like, you're behaving like a,
but you're also like so happy to see the transformation that you're talking about in that scene, you know, there's a glory in the recognition and change of the of the person, you know. All right, the first film that I would say was a life changer, the movie that is my first recognition of film, was Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. It was the first movie I owned when I was 6 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I had all the action figures. I had like the tree fort and everything. And I would act out scenes from that movie as I would like walk home from school. And that was like that to me, I think, set the stage for the whole career. Mm-hmm. So that would be an example of
learned your British accent from Kevin Costner in that movie, who has no British accent. Yeah.
That would be an example of a movie where it's not the content in any way. It was more of like that, for whatever reason, that film grabbed me in some sense, that maybe it's just a spectacle thing, but it awakened something in me in a creative way. You know,
sometimes
you'll look at something or watch someone do something and it makes you want to emulate it.
Mm-hmm.
Other times you watch someone do something really talented and it makes you never want to do that thing, 'cause you're like, I could never touch that, you know? And I'm not sure, both of those things could be great. I'm not sure why some creative things that I see have that effect. It's the same thing with music. Like listen to Kanye West, and that made me want to try making hip hop and rapping.
Mm-hmm.
Watch a Jay-Z concert and I never want to touch a mic again, you know, like they're both great, but for whatever reason that his stuff made me think, oh, I can do that. You know,
I think Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, that movie captured like a certain atmosphere, you know what I mean? Like it captured that world.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of iconic just scenes and imagery from that movie. I mean, him firing the arrow the flaming arrow, you know, or like the fight with the on the river with the staffs.
Six, yeah.
Like it's just so iconic. And then Alan Rickman, you know, is such an iconic villain. I feel like, especially when you're young, those movies that build the world like that and just create that like transcendent feeling.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that's really, really powerful, especially when you're young.
What do you remember as your like first movie that you remember being like your first favorite? Like
when I was a kid, what would I say was my favorite movie? I don't remember. I mean, Braveheart was an early favorite for me. That was another movie where the first time I saw it, I was probably too young to watch it.
I was going to say,
but I didn't realize.
You didn't see it in theaters.
I didn't see it in theaters.
So do you know how old you were when you saw it? Cause I mean, it came out, you would have been like 8 when it came out.
Yeah, I saw it pretty soon, though, after it came out on video and I saw it. And again, it was one of those like when he dies at the end, I remember feeling this sense of like injustice. Like, I can't believe that they would do that to him. You know, it just hit me. But like his heroism in the movie, you know, juxtaposed with how he's treated at the end.
Yeah.
I mean, that was just such a gut punch, you know?
The other thing I was going to say, I'm sure lots of people watch movies when they're younger and then want to act out the movie. But with Robin Hood, I didn't just act it out. It was, it made me want to make things. So I remember 8 years old getting the camera and then making not Robin Hood, but it was like the first thing that first video I ever made was Romeo and Juliet, but I was doing scenes from Robin Hood in as if they were supposed to be part of Romeo and Juliet. So you could tell it was like the difference between just playing or whatever.
It was the Kevin Costner Shakespeare mashup.
Yeah, he was like, you know, I'm a character. Yeah, I don't think Romeo ever rode a horse, to my knowledge, but I'm riding a horse as Romeo, and I'm singing the theme music from Robin Hood as I'm being Romeo, you know. But I was just thinking
that
about...
That sounds like a great YouTube mashup.
Yeah.
You know?
But it made me want to make things. Mm-hmm. Do you remember, like, what influenced you to first actually make something yourself?
So, my youth pastor, he used to talk about movies a lot. And I think this is part of what influenced, like, my feeling that movies should be significant. Like, my youth pastor in middle school and high school, he would show popular movies and he would really talk about what they were communicating. And I remember he showed us Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. And he just talked about the whole idea of, like, everlasting life and eternal life and how, like, well, for in that movie, for the Crusader, eternal life is a curse for him because, like eternal life, it's still in a world of sin, just like the Genesis 3, like, you know, we've got to keep Adam and Eve from eating of the tree of life so that they don't live forever in their sin, right? That whole idea was just, like, he would really dive into those ideas. And he also showed Raiders of the Lost Ark. And what's interesting about Raiders of the Lost Ark is Indiana Jones is completely ineffectual through that whole movie. If anything, he helps the Nazis because he's the one that discovers the Ark. But, like, okay, other than him helping them discover the Ark, the Nazis still end up on that island opening up the Ark, and God takes them out. And so, like, what's interesting about that movie is, I think my youth pastor said something about, like, the sovereignty of God and, like, God not needing us, you know, like, he is, he's glorified in us, but he doesn't need us. And, you know, like, it's just, it's one of those things that most people don't realize about the movie, but you know, it's there. So I think, but that dialogue that my pastor had with us about the movies, I think that's something that really inspired me to think about movies that way, and also just keep considering that, like, yeah, this is a medium that can reach people in a way that nothing else can, because it's so entertaining and it's so, like, transcendent in that it takes you into a new world, but it also communicates a worldview.
What's another movie that changed your life?
Another movie that changed me. Well, you'll make fun of me for this one, but Collapse. It's another documentary. These are documentaries. Interesting.
I remember.
So Collapse.
We were living together.
We were living together. Yeah, mm-hmm. And you watched Collapse first, and then you showed it to me, mm-hmm. And that really did change my life because Collapse is about this guy that.
Now I know where you're going with this.
Well, okay, so he like lives in the basement of his house, like it's like a bunker or something, yeah. With his dog. And he eats vegetables that he grows by peeing on them because he thinks that makes them more nutritious. Uh-huh. And he's talking about peak oil. But the thing is, like, him talking about peak oil, he sounds very sincere and very convincing. And he makes this very compelling case,
yep.
That basically the whole world is going to collapse, like, within our lifetime because we're going to run out of oil. And what I didn't realize and what he teaches you is that everything in your life is based off of oil. You're sitting on oil, you're eating oil, you're driving oil, like, mm-hmm. Just our entire industrialized society is based on oil. And even the alternatives to oil are themselves derivatives of oil. And so he's just talking about like how to live in a more how to live in a more environmentally safe way. And he's kind of crazy, but he's also like, what's compelling about the documentary is he is so convincing. And after I saw that, I just started to think about like the environment a lot more. Mm-hmm. And not so much, what's interesting is not so much climate change, which is usually what people talk about like right away, mm-hmm. but just like being environmentally conscious and like waste,
mm-hmm.
the waste that we you know, just throw away on a daily basis. And so like I started the worm bin. Yeah. You know,
which led Gabe to create for a short time a compost.
It was a long time. It was like a couple months. I had a compost bin
that
I got worms
looked like it was a box full of hell. It was the most disgusting. Oh man.
It was good for the environment though.
Yeah. It was like nothing I'd ever seen before. It almost looked like oil. It was like a dark black, like disgusting. It was like what venom comes out of, like oozing black substance.
It was a symbiote. Yeah. It was a good thing. Yeah. I didn't let it latch onto my face.
So, but why did you stop doing the composting bin?
I mean, it was just too much work. It just wasn't feasible. So, and that's the problem with a lot of environmental efforts. It's just like, man, how do we turn this into something that becomes realistic that people will actually do? But I still really do care about the environment a lot. I think it's a huge deal. Like I still try to avoid a lot of unnecessary plastics.
Mm-hmm.
And that all traces back from that movie. Like, I really care that there's a continent made of plastic in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, yeah. Pacific Gyre.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's really bad. That's not responsible of us as humans. And I do care about that. And that movie woke me up to that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, another, speaking of worms,
mm-hmm.
I got worms. That's another movie that changed my life. Dumb and Dumber.
Okay.
I mean, that is still, I think, the funniest movie that's ever been made. And because just almost every line in that movie is a joke and it's quotable in casual conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And the characters are dumb, but the lines are so smartly written.
Yeah.
You know, and I just feel like that movie, especially I was at the perfect age to discover that movie, and it was a revelation.
I'm with you there. I've watched that movie probably more than any other movie.
Yeah.
Like it's all the time, anytime, I always feel like watching it.
And I feel like it influenced my sense of humor a lot,
mm-hmm,
too.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think for me on a very like personal level. I keep thinking of movies that like I remember when I watched them and how much I thought about them and how they resonated as art, but I can't think of how it affected my view on something necessarily.
Mm-hmm,
like
mm-hmm.
I remember watching American History X, and I was like,
oof,
14, 15?
Yeah.
And it just, every image in that just like has stuck with me the rest of my life. Like, right. There's just something about that movie, but it didn't make me think differently, or so I'm trying to think of other things more along that. It, you know, I would say the same thing for like Requiem for a Dream. Like that was a movie that like I could never shake from my mind.
Yeah, you know? Like, that movie was okay. Like that solidified my certainty that I won't ever do drugs.
Yeah, like, okay. I guess that is a life changing.
Yeah, I wasn't gonna do drugs probably anyways, but seeing that movie was like, yeah, definitely on the straight and narrow, not doing drugs.
Okay, I would say.
But American History X, I recently watched that, and that is still a really powerful movie. And that, what's crazy about that movie is, they give these horrible racist people, they give them a lot of like latitude to air their worldview. Mm-hmm. Like they have whole speeches that he's giving that is just totally awful. And yeah. I thought that was interesting that you let this guy spew so much hatred.
Which is similar to Black Klansman. Have you seen?
I haven't seen Black
So
Black
I think Klansman. Spike Lee lets them do that too. But the difference in Black Klansman is you're always laughing at it. It's not like, like you should be laughing at it because it's wrong. But I feel like in American History X, it's taken more seriously, you know, I don't know. It just has a different attitude towards that, you know, but Spike Lee does the same thing. He kind of lets the people hang themselves with their own stupidity.
Right. And I really want to see Black Klansman. I haven't seen it yet, but, that's really interesting. I mean, it's kind of like reverse preaching, you know, because some movies you watch and it's like, this is too preachy. Mm-hmm. They're preaching at me. Mm-hmm. And the American History X is like, I'm just going to let the opposite worldview that you hate preach at you.
Mm-hmm.
And just like, let it, like you said, hang itself from its own noose.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's really interesting.
Speaking of Spike Lee, I would say, I don't think there's a particular movie of his that I would call out in this way, but looking at all his films and just what he's done in his career, I remember I watched everything that he had done while I was at Biola in college, and it kind of hit me making a connection between him making films from a very particular cultural point of view, but people from any culture could connect to it. That's what I always felt like. He could be super preachy about his positions and social issues and whatever he did, and he could be very much making a movie that's for and coming from a context of being an African American, but me as a white guy with no connection to his world at all could engage with it. And I always like, you know, tried to figure out why that is. Why, you know, how come someone making something from a Christian context and the Christian culture, whether you want to be associated with that or not, or feel like there should be a culture, there are things that make up the Christian culture, but no one has successfully made something that is super steeped in the Christian culture that people outside of it wanted to watch or connect with. But he did that for the African American context, you know?
Right. Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, there's a number of, I think one is like Christians are afraid to be self-deprecating.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think they've just started to realize, like there's a lot of empathy to be gained, or like we can be endearing if we make fun of ourselves a little bit, you know? I wouldn't say that about like, you know, necessarily the films of Spike Lee. I mean, I don't know. That's a tough. I don't know if I can say anything good.
I mean, maybe it's just the aesthetics of what he does that make it something. It's like must watch as someone who appreciates the art of it, and then you're willing to engage with his point of view because of the aesthetics. And if you're making something that doesn't warrant that kind of attention, people are not going to go along with you in what you're trying to communicate.
It's a good question. I would just have to think about it more before.
I was thinking on a personal level, Boogie Nights was probably pretty impactful for me. In my history of, like every man, struggling with lust and looking at pornography and, you know, always trying to see, okay, what is the difference between pornography and just nudity depicted in film, and how do you define those things? And watching something like Boogie Nights that is about the porn industry, like every good movie, you know, movies are empathy machines, right? And there was something about, even though I might have been watching, you know, growing up, there were films that I probably watched just because I wanted to see nudity. You know, like I was seeking out a movie that I thought, oh, I'm going to see some boobs in this, so I'm going to watch it. And then
this is like your like Joe Rogan always wants to talk about MMA with his guests. This is your this is like your recurring topic. Well, you always want to talk about nudity with your guests.
But this is getting at something completely different.
Okay,
I'm just saying, you could have the intention of going in to watch something like Boogie Nights wrongly, like me, right? Whereas, I mean, I watched it when I was older, so that's not totally accurate, but still being excited by what you're going to see, you know? And what ends up happening is actually completely different. For me, it was like understanding how horrible pornography is because of the people and the lives that are wrecked by it, the people who have to make it, what has to be done for it to exist. You watch Boogie Nights and you don't come away like thinking porn is this great thing that people should be a part of and that it's a great life to live. And, you know, like, I don't think that's Paul Thomas Anderson's intention, you know, in making it, like trying to necessarily show that. But for me, when I watched it, it was like, oh, like how can I have anything to do with this thing? You know, like I look at what it does. Look at these people behind it and how sad this is, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think it had that impact on me in, just seeing the evil of it.
Mm.
And I think, I don't think that's the reaction that most people would get from watching Boogie Nights, but that's how it impacted me.
Mm. I mean, Magnolia, I think, is Paul Thomas Anderson's masterpiece. That movie really, that's another movie where you have a character who, like, has radical, like, It's not so much confession and repentance, but it's this character who, you know, Tom Cruise's character, you know, he's confronted with the truth that he's been dodging his entire career. And he's like, you know, you see it on his face. You know what I mean? That moment where he's like, okay, I am really not who I've been pretending to be this entire time. And I don't know. Maybe that's a thing with me, because, like, you know, characters that really come to a place of having to reckon with the truth rather than who they have so strongly been saying they are this whole time. You know what I mean?
I think, yeah, that's a really interesting thing that could endlessly be explored in film.
Right.
I would be remiss to not mention in a podcast about the most influential films, I have to talk about The Sixth Sense, because The Sixth Sense, that's when, if when I'm younger, Robin Hood was getting me into picking up a camera and acting and stuff. Sixth Sense was when it got real, and I was saying, I'm going to do this with my life. Mm-hmm. I saw that movie, and I came away wanting to be a filmmaker for a career, knowing I was not going to do anything else. Mm. And again, it has nothing to do with any kind of lesson or theme from the film. It's all just being blown away by the film itself, just as a piece of art and entertainment, you know. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But it just inspired me. I wanted to do what he had done.
Yeah. And people try to criticize that movie of like, oh, it's all about the twist and whatever. And I think that movie is really well put together. I think the twist at the end totally works. And I think the movie works even if it didn't have that twist at the end. But I think the twist totally works. And it is completely motivated. Mm-hmm. And it ties the whole thing together. It's like Big Lebowski's rug. The whole thing together.
Did you see Glass yet?
I have not seen Glass. I really do want to see it. I'm disappointed in the reviews, but I thought Split was cool.
Obviously when with Sixth Sense impacting me that way, I became, I was going to follow M. Night to the ends of the earth, and then Unbreakable is one of my all time favorites. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I continued to stay with him, and I'll still watch anything he does. And he has gone up and down, and had his career resurrection over the past few years. Although I don't know if it's not at Sixth Sense or Unbreakable level, he's not there. And I feel like if you look at Sixth Sense and who produced it and the team that was around him, you have Kathleen Kennedy and Frank Marshall are producers of that movie. Like, he was not given full reign. And I feel like the downfall of M. Night Shyamalan is him being given full reign. Like, he needs, and this is what filmmaking is. It's a collaborative thing. Mm-hmm. You need people. You can't quantify the effects of that collaboration,
Right.
And I think with M. Night Shyamalan, it's especially evident.
It's tough though, because it's like sometimes the team, you get the right team and it all clicks. But then other times you hear of, well, it was just like, it was like a bad mix, like, because other times a filmmaker will have more independence. It's like, okay, I just did what I wanted to do.
And they made a great thing. Yeah.
And it was great. Like, and I've felt that in my own filmmaking. Like, sometimes there's people that you work with that you're just not seeing things eye to eye. And maybe if they just took over the project, they would make something great. Or if I just took over the project, I would also make something great, because it's their specific vision or it's my specific vision. But like together, we try to do this kind of like compromise and blah, blah, blah. And it ends up saying nothing. I've had that happen. Whereas, something that was just like, all right, I know the vision of this. I know the tone, and like me having that control and that confidence that it's going to be what I'm going for ends up with something better in the end. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So I feel like it's like a case by case basis. Like, you can't ever say, oh, it's just, you got to give all the power to the director or whatever, or you got to have the team. It's like, really, you got to find the right
mix
of people with the material, you know? And that's when everything clicks,
Yeah.
What's fascinating is when you have multiple very talented people working on a project and it not working. Like, because like what happened with the Solo movie. I haven't seen the Solo movie though.
Oh yeah.
But I think Phil Lord and Chris Miller are brilliant. Yeah. I like all their stuff. I think is hilarious.
Yeah.
Larry Kasdan is one of the greatest screenwriters ever. Mm-hmm. Right. And Kathleen Kennedy is one of the greatest producers ever, but for some reason they could not work together. You know what I mean? Which is like, how does that happen? You have all these super talented people, but it's like, it's a bad mix. It's like flavor enemies, like when you have seasoning,
Okay. I don't do
much
cooking.
When you're cooking, you know what I mean? It's like, well, like, yeah. I think dill and fennel are like flavor enemies. Okay. I think maybe they go together, maybe they don't. But for, let's say they didn't go together, it's like they're fine individually, but then you put them together and it's like, doesn't,
yeah,
just doesn't work, you know?
Are there any other life-changing films you want to talk about?
I'm sure there are. I mean, so Catch Me If You Can, Steven Spielberg's movie, Catch Me If You Can. Mm-hmm. That is one of my personal favorite films of all time.
Mm-hmm.
That's usually not on people's top favorites or top Spielberg favorites. It's my favorite of his movies. And I think the reason that movie really resonated with me is the character of Tom Hanks, this character that is the law, right? He's literally is the law. He's the cop that's coming after Leonardo DiCaprio.
Mm-hmm.
But you also see that he genuinely loves and cares for Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah.
Like that was really instructional to me in my relationship with my dad. Mm. Because like there were times when my dad was like, it seemed like he was all authority, right? And he just wanted to like, you know, catch me, so to speak, for doing something wrong, or he just wanted to like lay down the law and I didn't understand why.
Mm.
And I think that's a common experience for kids to feel that way about their parents. Oh, they're just, you know, arbitrarily throwing rules down so that they can control me. But they're really doing it because they love me, mm-hmm. you know? And yeah. there's that great scene where he, where he finally does catch him and he gives him the handcuffs and he's like, no, I promise you, like, I'm not putting these cuffs on you out of some sort of like, I finally gotcha and now you're going to jail. I'm doing this to save your life. Because if you go out those doors, there are the French police who are going to kill you. Their instructions are to shoot you on sight and I'm trying to save your life, you know? And so that like paradox between like, I'm the law and I'm going to bring justice, but I'm doing it because I love you. Like that, that character and that theme has stayed with me my whole life.
Hmm.
So that movie is really
also
changed me.
A good metaphor for God as well.
Right, exactly. Mm. I mean, and that scene is so. I mean, that scene is kind of on the nose. I mean, I don't know how intentional it was, but he
it's Christmas.
Right. Yeah. And he says, do you have a child? And he says, yeah, I have an only child. Her name is Grace. You know, do you swear on your only child that you're trying to save me now? Wow. And he says, yeah. And it's like, okay, you know, who else swears on their only child named Grace that, you know, bringing you under their custody is saving your life. That's God that does that, you know?
Wow.